This is called "The Song Remains the Same."
To you from the Peach Trees block of the criminally underseen cinematic version of Mega City One, this is the fifth Long Box Graveyard Podcast. I am Paul O'Connor, and for the next 30 minutes or so, I will bring you up to speed on the latest happenings at my Long Box Graveyard comic book blog, and also bring you this month's feature, which is called Form Follows Function. Thanks for listening, whether you are a returning listener or joining me for the very first time. And thanks, everyone, for the warm response to last month's podcast, where my lad Miles and I got together for a special 90-minute show looking at Frank Miller's Holy Terror. Several of you contacted me saying that you found the show worthy or touching, and you were especially generous in your praise of my son Miles, who I think is pretty terrific when he's not being a fink, and it was nice to hear that echoed back from my listening audience. Thank you very much for listening to that show. It's been a good month for me, a busy month. I turned 50 at the end of September and celebrated by watching The Avengers on Blu-ray with friends and family. Also, that day I ran 3 miles and I got a parking ticket. Not in that order, and that's only part of the story. You can read the rest on my September 29th blog entry if you like. I saw the Judge Dredd movie with my boy Miles, but practically no one else did. Nor was there a lot of traffic for my Judge Dredd article at Long Box Graveyard. All of which is a shame, because I quite like the movie and would welcome a sequel, but it appears to be DOA at the box office. I've been doing a bit of traveling, having just returned from a week in Austin, Texas, for the Game Developers Conference. It's very busy. Unfortunately, I couldn't check out any of the comic shops in that town. I will be going to Shanghai in November for another developer speaking engagement, so my secret identity is keeping me busy, and that's nice. I've never been to Asia. I'm looking forward to this trip, though I'm not really looking forward to the 14 hours I will need to fold my 6-foot-2-inch frame into coach seating to get there. But you know what? It's a small price to pay, and I will risk deep vein thrombosis in the name of adventure and cultural exchange. On the comics front, I've been doing some reading, of course, issues to support the blog, the reviews I do there, but I've also been rereading Jack Kirby's Mr. Miracle and a few of his other New Gods titles. I doubt I'll review them at the blog, but it's been fun to revisit those stories. Anyway, on to the news. And here's what you'll see in the month ahead at www.longboxgraveyard.com, where there's a new blog posted every Wednesday by yours truly. Wednesday, October 17th, is reopening the Tomb of Dracula. I last looked at Tomb of Dracula a year ago, which is hard to believe, but it's been a whole year since I reviewed the first 25 issues of Tomb of Dracula. This time I look at just three issues. I want to say they're issues 26 through 28 or something like that. A three-part story that starts to focus down on the Tomb of Dracula DNA, where it's really about the personal relationships between the characters and Dracula attacking, not attacking those characters so much as attacking their beliefs and their faith. It's an interesting tale. I hope you'll check it out. Tomb of Dracula, I think, is one of the underappreciated and best Marvel Comics series of the 1970s. Certainly, it's one of my favorite, along with Master of Kung Fu, which was reviewed last month at Long Box Graveyard. So on the 17th, join me for Reopening the Tomb of Dracula, where we look at this classic series from Marv Wolfman and Gene Colan. On the 24th of October will be the Guide to Comic Books on Instagram. Previously in my guide series, I've looked at Pinterest. Now I look at Instagram, a substantially more popular program that perhaps you haven't thought about using for comic book images. Certainly that's not what it's designed to do, but that didn't stop me. I'll tell you how I use it for comics, how you can use it for comics. And if nothing else, you can see some of the images I've shared on that service. I welcome you to join me there. See if you can guess what my username is. Yes, it's Longbox Graveyard, but of course there's a clever underscore between Longbox and Graveyard. So look for me, Longbox underscore Graveyard on Instagram. Take a look at some of my images, and then join me on the blog on the 24th as I offer my insights for sharing comic book images on Instagram. On the 31st of October, it's Halloween, and I will mark the occasion by reviewing The Walking Dead. Yes, I know it's a shock. I'm reviewing a comic from the present century that I quite like Walking Dead. I'm a little late to the party on this one. Walking Dead doesn't need any endorsement from me, of course. It's a gigantic hit, both in print and on television. But for all the words that have been written about it, I think I may have some slightly special insights. So join me on the 31st of October for my review of The Walking Dead. First 48 issues, which are available in compendium form. And a new compendium form of the second 48 issues, I believe, is due out soon if it isn't already out. The Walking Dead on Halloween, 31st of October at Longbox Graveyard. And then finally, coming up in November, November 7th, Wednesday, will be an essay on Marvel Value Stamps. Marvel Value Stamps, of course, the bane of Bronze Age collectors. Those little squares of non-sticky paper that so many of us cut out of our vintage comic books because we were kids, and that's what you did, and it was fun. And I can't say I really regret it because, you know, so what, really? But it does pay me to report that I did cut the Marvel Value Stamp out of my copy of Hulk number 181, First Appearance of Wolverine, which were in mint condition, could probably put my kids through college. But, you know, tough luck for my kids. So Marvel Value Stamps, my essay appreciation and insight on Marvel Value Stamps coming up on the 7th of November at the blog. Also, as you remember the 7th of November, over at stashmycomics.com in my Dollar Box column, I will have a review of Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow, the two-part Alan Moore Superman story from the 1980s. Much is being made of the current wave of DC Comics reboots. The New 52 is into its second year. Of course, it's just one in a long series of reboots, refreshes, restarts that DC and other comics companies have attempted over the years to clean up their continuity and reinvigorate fans' interest in their properties. Arguably the first and the greatest of these reboots was Crisis on Infinite Earths in the mid-80s from DC Comics, which is neither here nor there, but with that reboot, it afforded Mr. Moore the opportunity to tell the final Superman story, because both Superman and Action Comics were being canceled in view of that sweeping change to the DC line. And of course, they'd be uncanceled later. And it's an imaginary story, and maybe it doesn't count, but you know what? It's one of my favorite Superman stories and one of my favorite comic book authors. So at stashmycomics.com on the 7th in my Dollar Box column, look for my review of the two-part Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow. And also, because I won't be talking to you again before Halloween, let me wish you a happy Halloween, which I am celebrating this month with the aforementioned Tomb of Dracula and Walking Dead reviews at Longbox Graveyard. I'm also doing some Halloween-themed Super Tuesday entries. Super Tuesday, I haven't mentioned it on the blog before. I don't really go out of my way to promote it on Twitter or anyplace else, but even though my primary day for publication at Longbox Graveyard is on Wednesdays, on Tuesdays of every week for the last 2 or 3 months, you can find a feature called Super Tuesday. And all it is just a scanned ad from a Marvel or DC book, vintage ad from the 70s probably. It's just something I find interesting or relevant maybe to that week's Longbox Graveyard. So for the I think it's the last two Tuesdays of October, I'll be looking at Marvel House ads for some of their horror books and also from some merchandise that they pushed out around the Halloween time. So if you're interested in those things, check it out, Super Tuesday. But most importantly, the Tomb of Dracula and Walking Dead reviews this October, celebrating Halloween at Longbox Graveyard, which is a spooky enough place the other 11 months of the year, but in October we make a special effort. Whatever the month, I hope you will drop by the blog, read an article, leave me a comment. I'm sorry to report that traffic has been declining at Longbox Graveyard these past 3 months. This is me. I'm making a sad face. I'm down about 7% traffic in that time. I don't know if this is seasonal or a reflection of a lack of interest in recent topics, or you're just getting sick of me or whatever, but it's a little discouraging. So if you're a regular reader who hasn't been by the blog for a while or a listener who hasn't yet visited the blog, please drop by www.longboxgraveyard.com. And if you're a regular visitor, please tell your friends about the blog, as a growing or at least a steady readership is one of the rewards of this wacky blogging business. And with that plaintive bit of whining over and done with, let's get on with this month's feature, which is Function Follows Form.
Hear my song. People want to listen.
This is a time of hand-wringing in the comics community as digital comics continue to make inroads and fans and publishers grapple with what makes a comic book a comic book. My August podcast on digital comics and the illusion of ownership outlined many of my feelings on the subject, so I won't restate them here. But I do think it's worth restating that we live in a time of vast and rapid technological change, which is disrupting many forms of entertainment, not least of which are these comic books that we all cherish. I read and respect the reviews of many fans when they say they will never give up their paper, that they reject digital comics as an inferior form, that something precious will be forever lost as comics are transformed by this change wave. And they may be right. But I also thought it might be interesting to ask just what are comics, after all, and how do they get to be the way that they are? Is there some pure form of comics that should be respected above all else? If we're going to circle the wagons and defend comics the way they are, it behooves us to understand how they got to be the way they are. It's actually kind of accidental. We have a tendency to think of comics as being printed stories in a floppy format, staple bound, 20-odd pages in length, sold on a monthly basis for a shocking cover price. Or we might think of them as collected graphic novels. But where did this form come from? And does it stake claim to some special purity that puts it above these newer digital forms that threaten to alter the way comics are formatted, distributed, and experienced? I'm a history nut, and I love studying how new customs and technologies evolve, and in comics, we have an especially rich case to examine. Few forms of art are so intertwined with commerce and technology than comics. If you want to set up a canvas and paint a field of sunflowers, your experience won't vary greatly from the way Van Gogh did it, and your chances of selling your work may be equivalently dim. But the process of creating a comic book has changed extensively in the last 100 years, and more often than not, the process has changed faster than audience attitudes have been able to keep up. When examining what comics have been, are, and should be, it is important to understand the context of a comic's creation, which varies greatly by era. Comic books began as newspaper comic strips, and the framing of comic strip stories was directed by the architecture of the way newspapers were set up for print. The form's origin as black and white stories owes entirely to the cheap methods used to create newspapers. And when the New York World introduced color printing in 1895, it helped make the Yellow Kid comic strip a sensation. Newspaper page conventions were carried forward into the first comic books, which were cheaply printed and bound republications of newspaper strips. When the market showed an appetite for new material in comic book form, printing technology and the tradition of newspaper strips quickly settled on a compromise form that we still recognize today. Pages of panels of pictures and word balloons telling a story in sequential art. The four-color printing process established the parameters of superhero costumes, at least the most successful and popular ones, gravitating towards the red, blue, green, and yellow primary colors that the technology could handle. The length of the stories was driven by the most economical size where comics could be printed and the pace at which material could be prepared. Even the density of storytelling is linked to technology and commerce, and I find this part especially interesting. On his Art of the Comic Book website, David Marshall notes how in 1967, the comics industry settled on a then smaller standard of 10 inches by 15 inches for creation of original art, both because it represented the proper aspect ratio when shrunk down to publication size, but also, and here's the really interesting part, also because filling smaller pages with art consumed less film when printing and was cheaper and quicker to produce. An unintentional side effect was to reduce the amount of story that went into each issue, because while it might save time to make the art smaller, the same cannot be said of lettering those stories, which now covered more space proportional to the art, and consequently offered less text per square inch than had been the case when art was prepared on 12.5 by 18.5 inch boards. Abruptly, we have less text per page, all because of a change in source page size. So, the next time you're reading one of those Silver Age books that looks like a wall of words compared to the decompressed books of today, remember the change isn't entirely down to storytelling style. Those fewer words per page also have something to do with the size of the source art and the technology used to bring comics to the printed page, and also with producing comics at the lowest possible price. With comics distributed on newsstands for casual readers browsing on the racks, single-issue stories were the norm. Publishers were afraid a kid would pick up a book, see it was continued from a prior month, which they may never have seen given spotty newsstand distribution at the time, and then they'd put it back on the rack unsold. Consequently, sprawling multi-issue stories were a rarity for years in comics, and they felt like a big event when they first started to occur. After the development of direct market distribution, where comics were sold on a non-returnable basis, and readers could be better guaranteed access to each issue of a book, multi-part stories became the norm, with teams ultimately encouraged to tell their tales in 6 or 12 issue arcs, that the material might more easily be repackaged in standalone graphic novels later. So, in addition to a smaller original page size, the decompressed nature of modern comics has as much to do with distribution and republishing as it does with any artistic choice on behalf of creators or publishers. In discussing this issue at Longbox Graveyard, my pal and former Malibu Comics bigwig Tom Mason pointed out that even the numbering of comics is driven by market forces, and not just the recent and annoying trend of multiple number ones, zero issues, and the like. And the origin of those gimmicks we can kind of lay at Tom's feet at Malibu, but that's another story. But before the rise of the direct market, standing orders were the key to newsstand sales, accounting for issue numbering into the triple digits, the exact opposite of the current market style, which discovered that fans will buy number ones more readily than later issues in a book, and then numbered them accordingly. Likewise, as Tom pointed out, in this era, DC would cancel something like Mr. Miracle with issue number 18, then revive it 3 years later but start with number 19. Or, to go back further, when DC took over Black Hawk from Quality Comics, they kept the numbering in place, so the first DC issue is number 108. Or their first Tarzan issue, which carries over the numbering from Gold Key Publishers. So, newsstand accounts had long-standing orders based on sales patterns that were well understood. To alter the numbering by starting over at issue number 1 was to risk sales. Likewise, the best way to introduce a new character was in a book like, say, Marvel Premiere or Marvel Spotlight, which had built-in sales thanks to standing orders, rather than trying to establish a new character with a new number one issue right from the get-go. Even the assembly line nature of comics creation, with separate scripters, pencilers, letterers, inkers, and colorists, is the worst kind of artistic compromise, a factory system designed only to create pages in a hurry for regular publication. Even the longevity of the comic book form has had a unique impact on how stories are made and sold, with comic characters 50 or 100 years old far outliving the creators and by necessity passing into the hands of a succession of creative teams, changing characters over time, leading to fun arguments by fans over the definitive versions of their favorite heroes, and leading to very serious and bitter legal fights over the ownership of these beloved characters who are also immensely valuable corporate brands. And so, the next time you find yourself uncomfortable with a shift in comics form, whether it is rejecting digital in form of paper or in rejecting, as I so often do, contemporary comics in favor of Bronze and Silver Age titles, it might be worth remembering how much the comics form you most admire is an accidental result of forces entirely outside the purely creative requirements of making a comic story. The shape of the page, the length of the story, the density of the words, the quality of the colors and printing, the collaborative nature of many comics, even the frequency of publication and the number on the cover of your comic all have little to do with some ideal artistic expression, and everything to do with the technology, distribution, and business realities of the age in which it was created. And in view of this, maybe when encountering a new comics effort, like the Operation Ajax iPad app, or digital comics at Mark Waid's Thrillbent site, or the motion comics now coming out through Madefire, or DC's very worthy but conservative by comparison digital efforts like Legends of the Dark Knight, or Marvel's Infinite Comics, or the augmented reality extras Marvel is building into some books, maybe when encountering these or other efforts, instead of dismissing them as not being real comics, you'll remember that comics as we know them aren't a real or pure form by any standard, except pragmatism and tradition, and accept that this lively form will continue to change, must continue to change, if it is to continue to find audiences and also remain true to itself, which is to have been opportunistic, experimental, sometimes kind of low rent, and always changing into the most efficient possible form. These comics of ours, which more so than any other popular art, form follows function.
Hear my song. People want to listen. Sing along.
And that about brings us to the conclusion of another episode of Longbox Graveyard's podcast. A little shorter this month, but I'm balancing off against that 90-minute behemoth I had last month. A few bits of business before I sign off for another month. First, the plug of the month. This time it goes out to a comic shop, which won't do you much good unless you're in the Los Angeles area, but it's my podcast, so I get to do these things. This month, our plug of the month goes to the House of Secrets Comic Shop in Burbank, California. You can look them up, House of Secrets Comic Shop. You'll find them on the intertubes. It's a terrific little shop. I live in the North San Diego County area, and there's quite a good comic shop south of me, Southern California Comics, down in the Claremont area, San Diego, but it's a little beyond my range, and I have a hard time getting down there consistently. Business has taken me up to the Los Angeles area more or less once a week for the last couple months, and it's become part of my tradition after I've completed my meetings out in the east end of the San Fernando Valley to drop by the terrific House of Secrets comic shop in Burbank, California. So yeah, I do find it easier to do a 200-mile round trip to get to House of Secrets and then to get down to Southern California Comics. But, you know, that's just the weirdness of life. House of Secrets is a small shop, and maybe it doesn't look like too much from the outside, although it has some cool accoutrements, like a bench out front that's painted to look like Plastic Man in disguise, an image I shared on my Instagram feed earlier this month. Inside the shop, it's very cool. It's tidy. It's neat. It's air-conditioned, which is very important in the Valley. Always some nice music playing. And a wonderfully curated stock. Unlike many comic shops where I feel sometimes that I'm walking into someone's garage, regardless of the neatness of the shop, the things here are, they have an expert buyer. He's really got a good eye, whoever it is. You can't look any direction in the House of Secrets without seeing some really cool stuff that you want to buy. And believe me, that's a unique experience for me. I walk into comic shops all the time and don't find anything that I want. But at House of Secrets, I always open my wallet. And, you know, it's even to buy things that I know are available at a discount online. It doesn't matter. It's a good shop, and I like to support it. Friendly staff, cool stuff to look at. Focus very much on comics. No trading cards here. Very few toys, but a great selection of graphic novels. New comics. A respectable back issue bend of silver and bronze age books. Decent prices, friendly people, great store. I wish I had a shop like this closer. I'd go every week, but as long as I'm traveling up to LA, I always try to find times to drop by the House of Secrets comic shop in Burbank, California. Check them out. Tell them Longbox Graveyard sent you, and they'll be totally confused. I'm completely anonymous when I go in there. They have no idea I'm giving them a plug, and they probably wouldn't recognize me. They couldn't pick me out of a lineup. But House of Secrets, I love that place. Finally, where to find me? Well, you know, on Tuesdays in the afternoon, you might be able to find me at House of Secrets Comic Shop. But the rest of the time, you have to find me online. You will find me on all the usual places, Facebook, Google+. I told you that I'm on Instagram now. Please check that out, Longbox_Graveyard on Instagram. Of course, you will find me at www.longboxgraveyard.com. which is my blog site, where I welcome your comments. I certainly welcome your views. Please feel free to leave me a comment there. All comments are returned in kind. Also, you will find me on my Twitter stream as at LBox Graveyard, LBOXGRAVEYARD, at LBox Graveyard on Twitter, again, where I'm very active. You can expect a response within a day or so, if not immediately. So post there, and I will reply. Tell me how I'm doing. Give me suggestions for future shows. Buck up my spirits. Tell me to continue both this podcast and my blog. Not that I'm going to quit, but it's nice to get your encouragement. I appreciate the tailwind provided by all my many readers and listeners. Thanks to all my supporters here and on Twitter and on the blog for encouraging me in my continued efforts at Longbox Graveyard. Also, thanks to Mo Christensen at the We Talk Comics Podcast Network for engineering and hosting the show, as always. Thanks, Mo. Appreciate it. Until next time, have a happy Halloween. Be sure to visit me at www.longboxgraveyard.com, and I will see you in the funny papers. The form of which changes according to technology.